Two men on two continents found a new use for a new technology. The technology is 3D printing. It's promising a revolution in how many things are manufactured and designed. The two men are a carpenter in South Africa and a mechanical puppeteer from Washington State. Together, they designed a 3D printable prosthetic hand for children. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
2 hours north of Seattle, Ivan Owen, a special effects artist, turns on his 3D printer.
This is essentially like a robotic hot glue gun.
Hot plastic soon squeezes through the tip, laying down layer upon layer until it can form anything from a simple plastic square to a finger.
The complexity of the human hand has always fascinated me, really captured my imagination.
One of Owen's specialties is making large mechanical puppet hands. But these hands actually don't require a 3D printer. The printer's here in Owen's home because it was donated by MakerBot, the manufacturer. To understand why Ivan Owen got a free printer, we have to go back a bit and meet Richard Van Ass. Van Ass is a carpenter.
I make all the high-end stuff. That's what I do.
He lives halfway around the world near Johannesburg, South Africa. And in the spring of 2011, Van Ass was working with a circular table saw in his shop.
It's a possibility that it was a lack of concentration, or you become a little bit sort of cheeky with the machines. It's just the inevitable happened, you know.
An accident where he lost two fingers and mangled two more. For a carpenter, this was his livelihood. But buying a prosthetic was financially impossible. It would cost thousands, and he wondered about the cost of replacements and repairs. So in the meantime, he rigged up an artificial index finger for his right hand with anything he could find in his shop.
It's actually not so easy to actually mimic what nature is all about and what a tendon and all these things can do. So it was trial and error, frustration, throw things away, try again.
After a few weeks, Van Ass had something functional, but he kept looking for new ideas, help, even a collaborator.
I don't think there's a website I've not been on. From the tinkerer to the professional robotics.
And then he stumbled upon Ivan Owen on YouTube, demonstrating one of his big puppet hands, where thin steel cables act like tendons and allow metal digits to bend. Van Ass emailed Owen, and the two began working long distance, Skyping, sharing ideas, even sending parts back and forth.
If we wanted to refine it, we had to try and build a copy of what the other person had created. Then decide what to refine on it or what to change.
Months passed and a friend of Van Ass donated frequent flyer miles so Owen could come to South Africa and finish the work in person. And today, Van Ass has a working mechanical finger to assist him with his job. But something else even more seminal occurred on that short visit. Van Ass received a call from a South African woman whose 5-year-old son, Liam, was born without fingers on his right hand.
I didn't know what amniotic band syndrome was until then.
Amniotic band syndrome, or ABS, happens to fewer than 1 in 1,000 kids. Sometimes, fibrous bands in utero can wrap around a hand or a foot and cut off the circulation to the digits as they develop.
And would we see if we can help him? Me and Ivan looked at each other type of thing and said, yeah, easy, no problem.
Within days, they ended up developing a crude mechanical hand for Liam, with 5 aluminum fingers that opened and closed with the up-and-down movement of Liam's wrist. Ivan Owen still remembers Liam's reaction when they rigged the device on him for the first time.
He bent his wrist and made the fingers curl. You could see the light bulb go off. And he looked up and he said, it copies me. It was a really incredible moment.
And this is where 3D printing enters the picture. When Ivan Owen flew back to the States, he wondered if the device they're now calling RoboHand could be turned into printable parts. He emailed MakerBot to see if the company would help out. By now, there were a few videos on YouTube to watch, including Liam being coached by his mother to pick up a ball.
Nice!
They came back to us and said, listen guys, would you consider accepting a donation of 2 printers, not just one? We said, oh, great stuff. Yeah, then there was no stopping us, of course.
What had taken weeks or more, milling finger pieces, adjusting and tweaking, now took 20 minutes to redesign and print and test. Eventually, Liam's crude hand was replaced with the improved 3D printed version.
After practicing with it for a little while, Liam was able to pick up a coin, grab objects of different shapes and sizes. He's a really determined little guy.
And with a 3D printer, parts for the new hand could be replaced quickly. You can scale up the size of the hand as the child grows. So they put the design and instructions on Thingiverse, a website where anyone can download it and make a hand for themselves, with parts costing just $150. That is, if you have access to a printer and the time to assemble it.
This is Paul McCarthy. We live in Marblehead, Massachusetts. This is my son, Leon McCarthy. He's 12 years old, was born with amniotic banding, so he has no fingers on his left hand.
McCarthy and his son worked together to make a RoboHand, using a friend's 3D printer. Printing parts was easy, but it took them a month to figure out how to string, screw, and bolt it together into what they describe as the Frankenstein version. It's still a work in progress, but several weeks ago, Leon McCarthy wore it to school for a tryout.
I'm able to hold a pencil, piece of paper. I've done a lot more than I ever thought I could, so it's opened up a lot of new doors in my life.
Paul McCarthy says there were few suitable options for Leon. The doctor's advice when he was very small, get used to the hand without prosthetics. Acquire full range first.
So the last time he went to visit his hand doctor, he recommended maybe we could start looking for prosthetics.
And that's when Paul McCarthy found the YouTube videos of little Liam in South Africa. And Liam was just the start. Richard Von Ass has been besieged with requests. He's personally fitted over 100 children with RoboHands in between work and his job. He charges nothing. It's been hard for Von Ass to say no, but he'll soon have to. In the meantime, he's raised money and is hoping to train others to help.
You know, many hands make light work, so the more people that are doing this, more and more people will get hands.
Like 12-year-old Leon McCarthy, whose dad, Paul McCarthy, will never forget his son's reaction the day he wore his RoboHand to school for the first time.
Comes bouncing out of school with, like, this biggest smile. It was like, look it, it's working, you know? The Frankenstein hand is functioning. I am holding my lunch bag.
Getting the fit just right has been hard. Experts in prosthetics say users are bound to have these kinds of complications. But with proper support, many see tremendous potential. RoboHand offers similar functionality to prosthetics that can cost thousands. And the world of 3D printing is moving fast. Last night, MakerBot released a new improved version of RoboHand designed to snap together like Legos. Materials for this version cost just $5. Steve Henn, NPR News.
I'm looking at some amazing images of this hand in action, and you can look at them too. Just go to our website, npr.org.
Diabetes is a condition that many people link to the overconsumption of sugar. But there's new research suggesting that something else can drive up the risk. Eating too much red meat or eating too much processed meat, like hot dogs. According to a new study, both can significantly increase the risk of developing diabetes. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey.
The number one driver of type 2 diabetes is body weight. So the most effective thing that people who are overweight can do to prevent the disease is to slim down. This was the advice that Tim Daly was given more than 15 years ago. His diet back in those days included lots of meat.
I remember Big Macs, French fries. He'd go to a party, hamburgers, hot dogs.
But then Daly says he enrolled in a program to help control his blood sugar, which was elevated. And one of the first things he did was to swap red meat for lower fat options.
A nice piece of fish, a nice piece of chicken. It's not like, oh my God, I gotta have steak.
As Daly started to eat more plant-based foods and cut back on portions, he noticed that it made a big difference. He started to lose weight, and as steak became a once-in-a-month kind of splurge, his blood sugar came back into the normal range.
It's incredible, and you really don't miss it.
So the question that some researchers have had about stories like Tim Daly's is this. How much of the success of keeping blood sugar in check is due to simply taking off the weight, and how much may be attributable to cutting back on certain foods, such as red meat? Frank Hu of the Harvard School of Public Health has tried to answer this question with a new study. He tracked what happened over time when people changed their meat-eating habits.
In our study, some people increased their red meat consumption, other people decrease their red meat consumption.
And what Hu and his colleagues found is that the people who started eating more red meat, on average 3 extra servings per week, of things including steaks and burgers, as well as processed meats such as hot dogs and bacon, were significantly more likely to develop type 2 diabetes.
Their risk was increased by almost 50%, which is really a large increase.
Now, what's interesting here is that this increase in diabetes seemed to hold true, even when Hu and his colleagues accounted for the effects of weight gain among the participants.
So what does this mean? It means that there's independent effects of increasing red meat consumption and diabetes risk.
In other words, it seems it's not likely just the extra calories and fat in red meat that are linked to the increased risk of diabetes. Now, there are a couple of theories about what might be going on in the body. One is that eating too much meat can lead to iron overload, which sets the stage for insulin resistance. Physician David Nathan, who directs the Diabetes Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, says the other theory has to do with compounds called nitrosamines.
Our understanding is that especially processed meats include these nitrosamines, which can cause inflammation, which are associated even with some poisoning of the cells that make insulin.
These are the beta cells found in the pancreas. Nathan says more research is needed to understand this. His advice to patients is to pay attention to the big picture. If you like the occasional hot dog, Nathan says that's okay, as long as you're aiming for a healthy pattern of eating overall.
Red meat should be considered in the setting of a balanced diet.
Not something to eat every day, but as people like Tim Daly have learned, something you can enjoy in smaller portions as a treat. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
In the United States, we spend $7 billion every year training teachers. Well, now a new study says many of the nation's colleges of education, places that spend that money, are failing. Teachers are not adequately prepared for the classroom, this study says. It was released by U.S. News and World Report and the National Council on Teacher Quality. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has a look at the findings.
Kate Walsh, president of the National Council on Teacher Quality, is on a mission to expose what she calls widespread malpractice in the field of teacher education.
Right now, much of higher ed believes that it's not their job to have a teacher get ready for the classroom on day one.
Her organization's study of more than 1,100 colleges of education found that 7 out of 10 programs did not adequately teach candidates how to teach reading. 9 out of 10 did a poor job preparing them to teach basic subjects like English, math, science, or history. Training in classroom management and the use of student data was lacking. The damage to K-12 education, says Walsh, is enormous.
School districts are spending billions of dollars to make up for what teacher training programs are not doing.
According to the study, some colleges of education are so bad, the study attached a consumer alert to their names with this warning: no prospective teacher should entrust their preparation to this institution because it doesn't provide even the minimal training to its candidates. On that list of the nation's 163 so-called worst teacher training programs is East Tennessee State University. Dr. Hal Knight is dean of the School of Education there.
May I look at the list?
Sure.
Just to see if they're in alphabetical. I don't know. I mean, I'm floored. I'm actually floored.
After all, says Knight, nobody has ever complained about their graduates.
Our employer surveys are saying that we're doing a good job. Our teachers are finding jobs. And the one measure of outcomes that we have had, which is the Tennessee report card, we've done pretty well.
That report card, says Knight, shows that East Tennessee State is producing teachers who are raising student achievement, which is why Leslie Poole and Brian Bee, both candidates to become reading teachers, say their program can't possibly be among the worst in the nation.
I feel prepared, and I feel comfortable walking into a classroom and being able to teach children.
Well, yeah, I am kind of shocked, you know, that we were listed at the bottom because I feel like I'm getting a good education.
The National Council on Teacher Quality zeroed in on two major areas: how education schools prepared students for the classroom and whether that preparation had anything to do with the growing demand on teachers to show they're actually raising students' performance. Kate Walsh says consumers, namely school districts and people going into teaching, need to know.
If consumers know which programs are doing a great job, they're going to gravitate towards those programs. They're going to stay away from ones that are weak. Those weak ones will have a choice. They either work to get a lot better or they will go out of business for lack of clientele. So that's our primary goal, is to just give the consumers a much better idea of where to go.
The goal is wonderful.
However, before we close down failing programs, we ought to have really strong data about which schools are failing and which schools aren't.
But this study does not offer strong data, says Arthur Levine, former president of Teachers College at Columbia University. Levine has spent most of his career trying to reform schools of education. He gives the study an incomplete for relying too heavily on course descriptions rather than actually observing how faculty prepare students for the real world. The bottom line is this, says Levine.
The measure of the success of any teacher education program is how well the graduates are doing with the children in their classes. That's really the only thing that matters, not the process by which we prepared those teachers.
Still, the study, with all its limitations, will have an impact, says Levine. The question is, how will institutions respond?
Actually, we don't expect them to respond at all.
Again, Kate Walsh.
I can point to a whole graveyard of failed efforts to try to get teacher education to change. What's different about what we're doing is that if they don't change, they're going to feel it in the pocketbook.
The concern, says Arthur Levine, is that this could backfire and further polarize the debate over the future of teacher education, whether it can be repaired or whether it's so broken it needs to be replaced. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Now here's a real estate deal you don't hear about that often. A team of young entrepreneurs just bought a mountain, an entire mountain, for an estimated price tag of $40 million. NPR's Elise Hugh went off to rural Utah to find out who the entrepreneurs are and what they're going to do with their mountain.
It turns out you can get to Eden, wind through canyons and over a river to arrive in Eden, Utah, an idyllic community an hour north of Salt Lake City. Hop in a stripped-down, open-top Suburban that sits on 45-inch tires to climb your way up Eden's big bragging point, Powder Mountain. At nearly 10,000 acres, it's among the largest ski mountains in North America, and it's mostly untouched.
Where are we now? Like at 8,200 right now?
I think
we're 8,200 feet.
That's 28-year-old Jeff Rosenthal. As some his age search for work that piques their passions, Rosenthal and his friends purchased this peak.
When we made those first phone calls, everybody's like, what? But that being said, you know that we aren't kidding.
They weren't. Rosenthal co-founded Summit. It's a company that, until now, has specialized in putting on invite-only event experiences, gathering bold-faced names in business, entertainment, and philanthropy. By buying a mountain, they're going beyond building conferences. They're building a permanent place for people with ideas.
Very many of the founders of some of the most innovative and written about tech companies and online companies are all part of Summit.
It's like Davos for millennials. Past events mixed art and adventure.
If you were at our Summit at Sea event, for instance, you could have gone tagging tiger sharks with University of Miami scientists and your friends. If you were at our DC 10 event, you could have gone off 20-foot waterfalls with some of gold medal winning kayakers.
Now these thrill seekers have a year-round playground that gets 500 inches of snow annually. The deal for Powder Mountain closed in April for the reported price tag of $40 million. Summit says it's not a bad price for such a well-preserved pocket of natural beauty.
That community is called Eden for a reason. It is a really unique rural community.
Mike Caldwell is mayor of Ogden, the closest actual town to Powder Mountain. The mayor says neighbors don't want to lose the peaceful feel here.
They're scared of it being Aspen or Vail and getting priced out of this unique rural environment.
Does that scare you?
That scares me a bit, yeah, sure.
Plans call for 500 home sites, a retail village, and rotating residences for artists. Caldwell says the mountain's previous owner, a private equity group, planned for much more. So much development that locals got the Utah legislature involved to slow down the equity group.
I think they got tired of the fight, and I don't think the model quite hit what they were hoping to see, and so they were happy to back away and let a different group come in.
Summit was happy to come in, and local resistance quieted. Co-founder Jeff Rosenthal.
We're certainly not traditional developers. Return on community is our number one intention, followed by the return on investment from the people that backed this project.
Investors pitched in $500,000 to $2 million each. In return, they can opt to build a mountain home. Summit says they're all helping to build a community.
We were inspired by the core concepts of the Sundance Film Festival and the Aspen Institute. You can build place around a shared ethos, and we look to build the coolest little mountain town in the world.
Count plenty of cool kids among the mountain's 50 or so investors. PayPal founder Peter Thiel, Olympic snowboarder Danny Davis, the founders of Wired magazine, and pop music hitmaker Dr. Luke.
I believe in them, you know.
If you don't know him by name, you know the songs he's produced.
I do have other real estate in other places, but it's a unique opportunity and a unique place. I hope that when my house is done, it's like, you know, I can ski and snowboard straight out of it on this beautiful mountain.
Back at 8,200 feet on the beautiful mountain, construction's underway on an events lodge overlooking what seems like everything. Summit's Thayer Walker plays Sherpa.
Beyond that is Wyoming, and then out there is Idaho. So from this point, actually on a clear day like today, you can see four states.
Looking out over a limitless horizon line, nature seems to send a message.
I don't think anybody in our community has felt like they've achieved what they're going to in this world, and now they're done. We are looking to continue to create great things in the world as we move forward.
Boundless ambition to match their mountain. Elise Hugh, NPR News.
Health apps are turning our phones and tablets into exercise aids, blood pressure monitors, even EKG transmitters. But apps like those have proliferated far more rapidly than tests to determine which apps actually work. For member station WBUR, Martha Biebinger has that story.
Christine Porter is hooked on the MyFitnessPal app.
This is like my main page here. So it's telling me that I have, you know, about 1,200 calories remaining for the day.
In October, after deciding to lose 50 pounds, Porter started typing in everything she eats, drinks, and any exercise she gets.
When I want to record something, I just click the Add to Diary button. I'm on it all day, either through my phone or through the computer.
Porter heard about the app from Ryan Sherman, her health coach, who turns a doctor's orders into a user-friendly action plan for keeping high blood pressure or sugar levels in check. Increasingly, says Sherman, patients with diabetes or heart problems are coming in, pulling out their phones and saying, hey, have you seen this app?
There's a new one every day. So it's trying to keep up with that. And if there's not one place to really look, that can be hard.
Which is one reason why many docs are suggesting but not prescribing apps. Doctors aren't sure which of the roughly 40,000 available apps do what they claim to do. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration divides health apps into two categories. There are those that help with healthy lifestyles and those that turn your phone into a medical device, say to take blood pressure or an EKG, and then sends those readings to a doctor. The FDA is revising regulations for apps in the medical device category. It does not plan to regulate diet or exercise apps. A few private companies are stepping in. Ben Choder started Haptik, a company that reviews apps and gives those that at least perform correctly a seal of approval.
It's the Wild West, and someone needs to come in and at least help the consumers and the clinicians and the providers and the payers at least sort through the 40,000-plus apps that are already out there.
Haptik will not say which apps work better than others or guarantee their safety. Still, some doctors say apps that work are transforming medicine. Dr. Eric Topol, the chief academic officer at Scripps Health in San Diego, says apps that monitor blood pressure or glucose rates can be more valuable than prescriptions to keep these conditions in check.
Because when we use a medication, we don't know whether it's going to work or not. And so it's much better when a person's taking their blood pressure on a frequent basis. The average person looks at their smartphone 150 times per day. All of a sudden, they're able to diagnose if their blood pressure is adequately controlled and what are the circumstances when it's not.
Topol says apps that control blood pressure will help prevent strokes and heart attacks and may mean doctors should prescribe phones and tablets in addition to apps. But Dr. Laura Ferris at the University of Pittsburgh urges patients to use apps cautiously.
It does make sense that people who download these apps and use them really understand that they are doing so at their own risk.
Ferris ran a study of apps that claim to detect cancer based on the picture of a mole. Only one of the apps sends your picture to a dermatologist. It was right 98% of the time. Three others, says Ferris, could be dangerously wrong.
The best of them missed melanoma 30% of the time. The worst of them missed melanoma over 90% of the time.
There are many unresolved questions about healthcare apps. Should all the information patients collect become part of their medical record, and how? Who in the doctor's office analyzes all a patient's numbers? Will insurers cover the cost of apps? Dr. Ben Crocker at the Mass General Clinic that is testing a few apps says those are questions doctors will have to answer because...
This is what's engaging patients. Patients are coming to their doc for the first time or their team saying, I've been collecting some information or I've been using this application. And that I think we can't ignore, no matter where this is taking us, no matter how Wild West it feels.
So download away, but be careful as we continue this adventure with mobile health. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
And that story comes from a collaboration of NPR, WBUR, and Kaiser Health News.
Okay, a new novel begins with the focus on a young man on the campus of Harvard University. He's high in a tower at Harvard, a tower from which he tumbles down. Alexandra James, a reporter who's called upon to cover that story, gradually discovers the young man's connections to the White House and to a mysterious man from Pakistan, who in turn is connected to a nuclear bomb plot. The red-haired reporter uncovering the story is the creation of Mary Louise Kelly, who's a familiar name to many NPR listeners. She was an NPR correspondent covering intelligence agencies and the Pentagon. She left her job to say in fiction the things she could not say as a journalist.
The things that you find yourself telling your friends, your family, are sometimes very different from the things that make it onto the air. And the crazy detail, like, you know, I was up on the Khyber Pass and saw these, you know, traffic stopped for goats and then got involved in a conversation with a smuggler and then this, that, and the other. That's some of the fun stuff, and that doesn't make it into the Daily Hard News reports. So that was kind of fun to go back through all my old reporter's notebooks and find some of the crazy details.
Well, you're going back through your whole life, if I'm not mistaken here, because you're talking about journalism. The main character of this novel is a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about Washington. You're talking about the intelligence beat. You also set parts of this novel, however, at Harvard University, where you went, and at Cambridge.
Where I went, yeah.
So you pretty much put your biography here in twisted form.
Well, this is the advice you get, write what you know, right? It was also, I found I was comfortable writing about places that I had visited, that I knew. So I went back to all the places that I wrote about in the book. The book opens, for example, with the murder of one of my characters, Tom Carlyle. He has climbed up to the top of the Elliott House bell tower. This is one of the dorms at Harvard. And he falls to his death. But I went up and climbed the bell tower and looked around, and I'd started writing the scene before I went up there and looked around and thought, oh, shoot, the window that I had him falling out of does not actually open. And, you know, on the one hand, it's fiction. I mean, I could make it up. You know, this window doesn't have to be nailed shut in my version of events. But I thought, you know, I might as well get it right. So I had to crawl around, find another window, kick it open for a while, and he falls out the other side.
You knew about this bell tower before, though.
I did. I had some of the most fun, though, going around in all of the places where I set a scene and trying to figure out just how exactly something would unfold or trying to find the one detail that would make this come to life for somebody who actually knew the place. I had one... probably my closest scrape with the law researching the book was out. There's a scene set at CIA headquarters at Langley. So I was out at a CIA Christmas party. They do a big holiday party every year. They, needless to say, will not let you whip out your phone and take pictures when you're out there. But afterward in the parking lot, raced back out, got out my reporter's notebook and start sketching. And this is late at night. I'm out in the parking lot and I suddenly feel this blinding light in my face, and I look up, and it's CIA security, who reached down and said, can we ask what you're doing, ma'am? And look down, and I'm drawing this very detailed drawing of all of the entrances and exits to the headquarters. So that took a phone call or two to sort out.
Well, let me ask more about that, because without getting into the detail that would give away the ending, we do end up meeting some CIA operatives, one in particular, and this guy's a cynical guy. He's got a dark view of the world. Is that a fair representation of the CIA types that you did meet on the intelligence beat?
Well, fair representation? I don't know. I do know that of a few of my old sources at CIA who I asked to read early copies of this, one of them told me there was a little betting game going at Langley over which real-life CIA spook that character might be based on.
Uh-huh.
He ventured a couple of guesses, and I said I would be a fool to confirm or deny any of those. So it's a bit of a composite. You know, by definition, a life in the CIA, in the clandestine service in particular, is a very strange one. You're being asked to go out in the world. You're being asked by definition to break laws in the country you serve in. You're being asked to lie, sometimes even to the closest members of your family. I think it's hard to maintain a great sense of optimism after decades and decades of doing that. And that's what my character's done.
He makes a statement in the novel that he thinks that a phenomenal attack, a nuclear attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda or some other radical Islamist group is inevitable. Is that a view you heard a lot?
Oh, yeah. And in my years covering national security, every time you actually sit down and have a longer conversation with people who are involved in counterterrorism, national security, and you ask them what keeps you awake at night, this is the answer I got over and over and over through the years, was the idea that some radical group could get their hands on a weapon of mass destruction.
But inevitable. Are there people who do this for a living who think that the best they can do is delay this?
In my experience, the higher level of security clearance of the people you're talking to, the more worried they are about this. One of the characters who I have in the book, who works at CIA, at one point tells my heroine, look, Pakistan is a country with more terrorists per square mile than any other country on Earth. And it's a country that is increasing its nuclear weapons stockpile faster than any nation on Earth. And he kind of laughs and says, what could possibly go wrong?
Did you worry at all about your depiction of Muslims in this novel?
I did, but I would also say that many of the non-Muslims in this book come across pretty bad. There's very few. I can't think of any sincerely and 100% positive, nice person in this book. Everyone has their complexities.
Even the main character, who's very likable,
the main character
has a dark secret. You decided to have a main character who begins by not really knowing what she's doing.
Yeah.
Why?
I thought it would be kind of fun to follow her as she learns how to do this. I mean, this is a path I had trod. You know, nobody's born knowing how to report on national security, and I certainly had covered the diplomatic beat and done some foreign news reporting, but that is actually a very different thing from covering the intelligence beat. When you switch over to covering the CIA, they don't do press releases. You can't wander around Langley. They don't tell you when they're traveling. Even if you happen to find out, you're certainly not invited to travel on the plane as a reporter. There's no directory that you can access and find out what anybody's phone number is or title. So it was really learning to do a very, very different type of reporting. And I had fun watching Alex James evolve along that path as she figures out, how do you make any progress in this world? You're chasing a huge story. You have a feeling something is out there, but it is really feeling around in the dark.
Mary Louise Kelly's first novel is called Anonymous Sources. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greene.